Swim started, and I'll start by saying that today is June 29th. It's a Thursday, 2017. My name is Liz Strong. I'm here with Michael Henry Adams. We are doing an oral history project for the New York Preservation Archive Project. So I'll just start by asking you, when and where were you born?
I was born in Akron, Ohio, which is a great place to be from. And when I was born there in 1956, it was the rubber capital of the world still. And I grew up in a more or less middle class family, and my father worked teaching American history and as a coach of cross country and track and tennis and golf, and but particularly of basketball. He'd been a basketball star at the University of Akron, and my mother was a registered nurse, and I have four sisters who are all younger, and came to New York in 1985 with the idea of attending the historic preservation program at Columbia, which eventually I did. And became interested in historic preservation because I was always interested in old things, and I was very close to my father's mother and my father's grandmother and to my mother's mother, and I was very much, from an early age, very much impressed by the old buildings that remained in Akron, particularly large old Victorian houses, which one by one, as I was growing up, seemed to be being knocked down and replaced by parking lots and gas stations and supermarkets. I was especially impressed, I think, because there was a house that was being knocked down when I was, I think, around 7 or 8, called, that had been, originally had been built as a house called Rose Hill, but by a man named Absalom Work, who'd been an early executive with the B.F. Goodrich Town Rubber Company. And the house was sold after his death to another rubber executive named William Christie. I believe that William Christie's wife's name was Rose, so they changed the name of the house to Rose Will Manor. And in the newspaper in Akron, it said that this house was being demolished and that it had pink marble columns, and that just seemed so amazing to me, because my great-grandmother in her living room had these mahogany veneer tables with marble tops. So that was very impressive to me, these tables with marble tops. But the notion that there was such a thing as pink marble, and enough pink marble to make columns, and that you would have pink marble and columns on a house and knock it down, just seemed inconceivable to me. But because I didn't have much notion that there was some kind of profession or advocation as architectural history or as historic preservation, and because I had some talent as making drawings, I for a long time thought that I would end up being an artist, and all of these interests, and even my interest in the arts, all of these things were clouded by race. All of these old buildings and all of my interest in the past were almost of necessity colored in a way that made me particularly interested in things that represented the white past, because that's what was, after all, was emphasized in one's education and on television everywhere in your life. And it was a very bizarre sort of thing happened, bizarre to me, at least looking at it in retrospect, is that, you know, I remember in the little primers that we read in the second grade, or what was it, the first grade, Alice and Jerry, that there was this segment of the book where Alice and Jerry go to visit grandmother away down south, and she lived in this house with columns, and so there again, these columns, and so this columns fixation. So I and that book and on TV, movies that were about the South, that talked about the past, that featured these white pillared plantation houses, staffed by slaves. In a bizarre kind of way, because the slaves were black and I was black, and because the houses were appealed to me, I thought, oh, well, these things, all of that had some fascination for me. But of course, I knew I'd been taught that slavery was wrong and evil and wicked, and so that caused this sort of conflict. But it didn't really amount to very much for a long time. So, you know, movies like Saratoga Trunk and A Band of Angels and even Gone with the Wind were just enthralling to me. And somehow, though I ought more readily to have been identifying with the slaves, I was identifying with slave masters and with their lifestyle, which seemed beautiful and appealing to me. And then, ultimately, as I got older, I thought, oh, well, you can no longer be enamored of old Williamsburg and of southern plantation houses and of Georgian houses in Annapolis or Charleston or Savannah. So by the time I was an adolescent, I began more and more to transfer my allegiance for old buildings to English country houses. And that sort of coincided with this thing that happened when I was, the biggest house ever built in Akron had been built by the founder of the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company, a man named Frank Seiberly, and he built a Tudor Revival house that was completed in 1915, that was the biggest house ever erected in the state of Ohio, and was very elaborate, and it was designed by this man named Charles Schneider, who was the Cleveland, Ohio representative of the New York firm George B. Post and Sons. And it was a remarkable house, or it is a remarkable house. It was given by the Seiberling family to a private foundation to operate as a house museum. And so when I was in, all while I was in When I think when I first when I was 12, I became a member of Red Cross Youth, and they had these summer volunteer programs, and at about the same time, I had my first job working in the public library closest to my house, and but the pay was such that I soon graduated to working in a local restaurant as a busboy, and then at a country club as a busboy, and so I was working, but I also was doing these volunteer things. So the first year, when I was 12, they wouldn't allow you to volunteer as a tour guide at Stan Hewitt Hall. So I volunteered instead at this nursing home called the Sumner Home, and they just by chance happened to be headquartered in an old sort of Tudor Revival house that had been added on to. So that coincided with my interest in old houses, and the old people who live there coincided with my interest in history and meeting them and talking to them about Akron of the past and about the American past in general. I remember there was this woman who was a journalist who had covered the 1938 Olympics in Berlin, and she was fascinating to talk to. And there was a poet named May Lord. Anyhow, so it wasn't until I was 13 that I was able to volunteer at Stan Hewitt Hall. And I think even that was still younger than they allowed, but the head of the Red Cross wrote, or the director of the Red Cross wrote a letter for me, and they let me volunteer at this house. Now, when I say that there was this conflict of race, well, part of that conflict was that for my mother, it was all well and good to volunteer at something and to be charitable, but like so many African Americans, she thought that the idea that you would work for free was just not ultimately a beneficial thing. She thought that I should be spending all of my time trying to earn money. And so that was a conflict. And then another was, you know, to go to Stan Hewitt Hall to volunteer there on Sundays or Saturdays, whichever day I would have off, meant that I would walk from my neighborhood, which had been a white neighborhood that by the time we moved there was mostly African American. But I would walk through all these other white neighborhoods to get to Stan Hewitt, which was in perhaps the most desirable neighborhood in the city. And so I remember that walking there one Sunday for the first time in my life, I think when I was 13, someone called me a nigger and said, "You should go back to your own neighborhood." I don't remember what I said to them or if I said anything. But that only happened that one time, and it didn't bother me that much. Anyhow, I volunteered at Stan Hewitt. I met the daughter of Frank Seibling, the man who built the house, so his daughter was, who was his second eldest child. She was Mrs. Milton Whateley Harrison, and she, by the time I met her, I think she was in her 80s, and she was very petite, and, but very elegant, and she had been in a automobile accident and had lost an eye, so she had one of her eyes was a glass eye. But she still drove, and at a very high rate of speed. And she had, when I first was a volunteer there, she had been away recovering from this auto accident, but she came back, and I was very interested in the history of her family, and she knew a lot about her family, and she was eager to tell me all about them. And but she was very interested in many issues, conservative political issues, and also issues about health. You know, she was one of the first people I knew who was interested in health food and who made her own yogurt and who had a campaign against the fluoridation of water in Akron, a losing campaign against fluoridation of water in Akron. But she and I met and sort of hit it off, and we discovered our birthday was on the same day, and she was very impressed with all the knowledge I had about English history and history of the decorative arts. And she, in fact, once explained for me my proclivity for this history in a way that at the time I found very flattering, but then later, the more I thought about it, the less flattering it seemed. She said, "I think you must have had a previous life in Tudor times, and that is why you're so knowledgeable about all of these things." So, and that was something else that was interesting, is that she, having come from a family that had of German immigrants in the 18th century who had soon become prosperous farmers and then become inventors and then industrialist, she really believed in the individual and in manifest destiny, and in terms of her father and his factory, she very much believed in paternalism and how her father had formed this company and knew all of the men in his factory and always had their best interest at heart and didn't need to have a union because he built housing for his workers and had all of their best interest at heart. So what's odd for me is to think how initially I had those sort of conservative values, but of course, being a child of my time and junior high school, being, you know, learning that after first being a hawk and thinking, hey, the Vietnam War, we should go over there and bomb the hell out of them and stop communism, to gradually thinking, no, this is unjust. Why are you going to someone else's country and telling them what form of government they should have? So ultimately, our politics completely devolved away from each other, but fortunately, never in a way that impaired our friendship, and I don't even think we ever talked about politics much, really. So that was good. But that's all to say that it took me the longest time to recognize that in turning away from English country, I mean, in turning away from Southern plantation houses to English country houses, that, you know, I just jumped from the frying pan to the fire, that the reason why Houghton has more mahogany than any other house in England is because the Waypoles were heavily involved in the sugar trade and the Caribbean, and it imported this mahogany directly from their holdings there and from Santo Domingo. And that, you know, William Beckford was the richest man in England because of his wealth derived from West Indian sugar plantations. And then, even further on, it gradually came to me that, you know, life is like a pointillist painting by Thoreau, that, you know, you look close up and you see this mass of all these distinct dots that seem completely isolated, but the further back you go and the perspective changes, the more you determine that everything is connected to everything else. And then if you believe that, then you come to realize that there is no beauty, no goodness, no wonderful anything that isn't touched somehow also by oppression and misery and everything that's bad. And particularly when you're talking about the world's great monuments, they all have some amount of oppression and exploitation associated with them. But then, like the Russians, who have so painstakingly preserved and restored all these Tsarist palaces, not because they are celebrating inequality, but because they realize that this beauty represents the sweat, the tears, and the blood of countless masses who died in order to make, to cause all of this magnificence to come into being, that therefore this becomes the cultural patrimony of everyone and ought to be preserved and celebrated as such. So, there is my justification for being obsessed to this day with houses built by and for the rich, and the thing that makes them all the more appealing to me now is knowing that, by and large, the rich are as unlikely to want to preserve them as anyone else, because they just consume too much of their wealth and they just don't want to bear the responsibility and the burden that such places represent to them. And therefore, ironically, places like Stanhewood Hall, which were built with such care and with such fine materials and such exceptional craftsmanship, that they were meant to last for centuries and were built by people who even entertained this fantasy that the riches that they had created would last for the centuries as well, and that there would be this dynasty of their privileged family going off and far into the distant future. Well, irony of ironies, you know, a house even like this one we're sitting in now. The inequality is coming back, and there are more individual families who occupy houses like this all by themselves, but far fewer than a century ago. And if you were to look in New York, and if you were to look at all of the grand houses that were built along Fifth Avenue or Park Avenue, there is not a single family that built some palatial house on Fifth Avenue that still occupies it. Not one. Even in a city that's got, you know, 20-some billionaires, not one family that built one of these places still lives there. So that's... represents progress on the one hand, but it then gives me the excuse to care for these houses, which otherwise I would have to abominate because of the inequality that they manifest.
I want to ask you something. You said that as you were growing up, African American history was largely hidden from you. So, in parallel to your appreciation of preservation, how did you become aware of the role African American history played? And
well, my, you know, despite the culture and the media around me, you know, my my family, they were aware of their history and they talked about it a little bit, not very much. And then by the time I got into junior high school, I had this one black teacher, I don't remember what her name is even, but she was interested in black history and she taught us a certain amount of black history. And the really fortunate thing about the time that I came up was that it was the dawning of the black consciousness movement of the 60s and the 1970s. And by the time I became especially interested in black history and culture, by the time I was an undergraduate in college, the library at the University of Akron had not only new books that were written by people like Jervis Anderson, who wrote this wonderful book called This Was Harlem, and David Lovering Lewis, who wrote this marvelous book When Harlem Was in Vogue, but they also had reprints of, or reissues of new editions of literature created during the Harlem Renaissance. And before that, in the Akron Public Library, you know, the Akron Public Library was really an exceptional library. Now all these libraries, not just in Akron, but all over the country, are completely messed up because they have this policy where they will, two policies they have, the libraries seem to have in general, is one, they have a policy where they will deaccession old books. Simply because they're old and because they figure that there are new books on the same subject that are coming out that are superior. So that's very bad. But then the other thing they do that's equally bad is that in New York, there's hardly a library you can go to that doesn't have a large portion of their old journals or their books or whatever stored off-site. And that means that, one, you have to know what they've got off-site, and two, you've then got to identify it and have and order it and have it get to you. And that's very different than going through an OpenStack library and where you've found some book in the card catalog that you're interested in. And then you discover that just because you're in the right section, that there are all sorts of other books related to the same subject, which you might not have known about otherwise if you hadn't just seen them adjacent to where you were looking. But the library then was wonderful. It didn't have an open stack, that is, a large portion of its body of its books were stored in the basement of the library, but such books as were out in the open, in the open stack, gave you this opportunity to find new things. And then once I made friends with librarians and asked them to let me look at the closed stacks, then I was able to find more things. But the thing about the Akron Public Library being so good meant that when the Metropolitan Museum of Art had their Harlem in My Mind exhibition, that featured this catalog that had a lot of newspaper clippings from the 1920s through the 1970s, but also had photographs, particularly photographs by the Harlem portrait photographer James Vanderzee. When that happened, they had that book. When there was a monograph of the work of James Vanderzee, they had that. And that was an incredible eye-opener, because the so-called primitiveness of African culture had not appealed to me as an American. And to discover books that showed African Americans in the early 20th century with fine cars and wearing fine clothes and promenading up and down the avenue, who in turn had written wonderful plays and poems and created great works of art, that was a revelation and made me want to come and see this place called Harlem. And then tying in with that, you know, my great aunt Cora, she had photographs of herself and her friends who, though they were mostly servants, because they worked for some of the richest people, and emulating them, they wore the latest fashion and they wore evening clothes to their annual Christmas party and all these things. And that was a wonderful tie-in that reinforced this idea. And as a young woman, my Aunt Cora had briefly lived in Harlem. So all these things made Harlem seem like this alluring place, fabled place somewhere. By the time I was in college, I had this friend who was also interested in African-American history. And we had met and been friends and then briefly dated, and because it took me a long time to get out of college. I didn't meet this guy until I was around 26, because I didn't come out until I was around 25. Anyhow, it almost became a kind of competition for us to see who could discover something new about the Harlem Renaissance. And when we each read about how some of the greatest personalities of this period of artistic and cultural foment, Langston Hughes and County Cullen and Edna Thomas and Dorothy West, that they were all gay and lesbian. That was amazing, a revelation. You see, that's the thing, you know. For me, history, the thing that makes history so compelling is that history is like a kind of time machine. You can travel in that time machine and go back and, irony of ironies, discover not other people or personalities, but discover yourself. People who've had the same interest and motivations and interest and desires that you have, and you wouldn't have dreamed that that was so, but there it is. And that, of course, is the thing that's so terrible about so much of the miseducation that happens in America, that the accomplishments of women and blacks and Latinos and gays are all so disregarded and dismissed. And so growing up, if you are from any of these groups, you can tend to feel insignificant or irrelevant in the scheme of things. I mean, that isn't to say that one oughtn't to have enough empathy that in reading Romeo and Juliet, that you oughtn't to be able to experience the universality of having parents demanding that you do one thing when you desire to do something else. But it's so much easier if you can see that these are people who look like you or whatever. I mean, and the thing of it is, too, is that, if you then have some kind of what people will consider some sort of aberrant interest, like mine in old buildings, people will say, oh, well, that's not your place to be interested in those things. Why are you interested in these things? It's not a part of your... You know, I started this preservation group in Akron, Ohio, called Progress to Preservation, and I was helped in doing it by this professor of mine named Don Harvey. And I was upset because more and more buildings were being destroyed all the time. And the sort of straw for me, the sort of last straw for me was there was this little modest neo-Renaissance building made out of white terracotta, designed by local architects named Fichter and Brooker, that had been built by Frank Seibling, oddly enough, called the Delaware Building. And it was had been bought by some bank in Columbus. I think it was the Huntington Bank? I don't remember. It had been bought by this bank, and they were going to take this terracotta building that had, I think, Ionic pilasters, and they were going to cover it all in bronzed mirrored glass and make it into a little bronze cube. And they did it. They did do that. So I thought, oh, damn. You know, there'll be nothing left. So I wrote a guest editorial for the Akron paper. Don Harvey, he suggested that. And I think I called it something like, "Why Can't More Akron Landmarks Be Saved?" And I proposed at the end that people who were similarly interested in preserving buildings from the past, that we joined together and form an organization called Progress to Preservation. And Don Harvey was very instrumental in helping me to write this because so many wonderful buildings had been destroyed that initially all I had was a long list of destroyed buildings. And he said, no. He said, you've got to include some success stories to show the alternative, what's possible. And I thought, well, there aren't very many. And some of the buildings I included even were sort of stretches because I remember the M. O'Neill department store that I included. It had been designed by Graham Anderson Probst and White. And it had had an alteration where they put these horrible sort of outsized canopies over the doorways to try to make it seem more modern. And fortunately, those have been removed. But I thought, oh, no, I can't include that. Look at that. But he said, no. So anyhow, I included a few adaptive reuse projects that I thought were questionable. But it worked. This group was started, and people did join, but it's very interesting what ended up happening in a conservative place like Akron. One is that the man who had been the chairman of the board of the Stan Hewitt Hall Foundation, a man named Robert Pfluger, who was a Sarbling family member, in a Stan Hewitt board meeting, he said to, because this had been in the paper and he'd read it and other people had read it. And so the executive director, a man named John Franklin Miller, he is a friend of mine, and he related to me how John Pfluger had said in this meeting of the board of trustees of Stan Hewitt, he said, "Where does Michael Adams get off telling us what to do with our old buildings? Our ancestors built these buildings. His ancestors were just slaves." So when John Miller told me that, I thought, oh, damn. And then the other thing that happened, which was less insidious, but probably inevitable, is that the people who I got who were interested in preserving Akron, the people who I gathered together, they were all white. And they all like to think of themselves as people who are connected to the powers that be. And the problematic thing about trying to be a power amongst the powers that be is that too often you're seduced by what you mistake for civility and correct behavior, which makes you unwilling to challenge things that people are doing that are terribly wrong, lest you offend them. And that almost always occurs to the detriment of what it is that you're trying to save. So that's very much the case in Akron, and because I was more confrontational, which I felt was, you know, essential, because I had had this job in 1970, what was it? I don't know, 1977, somewhere around there, a job where I worked with the then director of the Summit County Historical Society on a HUD-funded inventory of significant architecture in Akron. And the idea was we were supposed to identify buildings eligible for the National Register of Historic Places so that no city projects and no HUD funding would be used to adversely impact any historic resource. But what I didn't realize at first, and what exercised me so much that I almost quit in the middle of the project, was that inasmuch as this was happening through the city planning department, that they had all these development goals in the future. And so if we encountered some building like the Hotel Portage in the downtown, no matter how significant one might say that it was due to what it meant in terms of the history of, and development of the city. They wanted you to say that it was non-contributing, that it was a that it somehow it had been compromised in a way that made it insignificant. And this was just true all over the city, so I thought, oh golly, you know, how do you fight that obliquely? You just can't. You just have to come right up against it. So so all of this dancing around, I guess I really wasn't good at that kind of political thing. And as a consequence, within a year of founding Progress to Preservation in Akron, I was voted out of the directorship and replaced. But, you know, they still survive. They survive still. They still have no black members, and they are still overly cautious. But they have managed to get a local preservation ordinance enacted, and they have managed by hook or crook to stop some really lame brain schemes of the city of Akron. That they weren't successful in a campaign that they had to stop the city of Akron from destroying virtually every historic public school building they had. So that the one public the one elementary school I went to was this brown Ohio sandstone building called Krauss Elementary, and it was a sort of a English Gothic perpendicular building that had these rampant lions holding shields on the parapet. And but then far more significant to me is the school I next went to, Ferdinand Schumacher Elementary School, was completed in about 1933, I think, and it had the most beautiful, vibrantly colored terracotta reliefs all over the building, both Art Deco stylized flowers and plants, but also animal birds and animals and Native Americans and everything. It was wonderful. So that's too bad that that's destroyed, and destroyed for no good reason. I mean, at the time, the they said, well, you know, they wanted to make buildings that were more energy efficient. And, you know, all these LEED studies show that the easiest way to make a building, LEED's platinum building, is to take an historic masonry building and to give it insulation and that's much easier. But then one of the worst things I heard was that one of the big objections that they had to these historic schools was they were all 3 to 4 stories high, and none of them had elevators, and that both students and teachers did not want to navigate 3 or 4 flights of steps. Damn. And of course, that struck me too the last time I was in Akron, was that how the neighborhood that I grew up in was a place more or less known as Maple Valley, the Maple Valley Library, the Maple Valley Drugstore, the Maple Valley Barbershop. And one walked, or could walk, to all of these places. But now the library, the drugstore, the grocery store, they all have drive-through windows. And I thought, damn, who would drive from, but people do. Yeah. So it's, represents the degeneration of the culture. Well, having started Progress to Preservation in Akron, when I got to Harlem, one of the two things shocked me about Harlem. And it was mostly due to the media. You know, there'd been all these, I'd seen all these articles about Harlem. There was a a cover story in the National Geographic in the 70s, and there was a story in Ebony magazine talking about the little neighborhood in Harlem called Hamilton Heights, and it said, where the black middle class lives. Well, that was the first shock, was how little of the black middle class survived, that of those people wearing bowler hats and carrying walking sticks, walking on the boulevards, you know, their descendants had mostly fled from Harlem during the heroin epidemic or the crack epidemic. And then, and so the other thing that shocked me was how derelict and such poor condition such a large portion of Harlem was. And eventually, you know, things like learning that in the mid-80s that the city owned something like 80% of the housing stock because landlords had abandoned their properties and defaulted on their property taxes and not paid their water rates, and that you had all of these multiple dwellings which had hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of code violations. That was a surprise. But like the people who wrote those articles that I'd read before I got there, I too was optimistic that Harlem would rebound, and I thought, you know, in a slow and gradual way. And the shock and dismay has been the rapidity and the brutality of that rejuvenation, and how it has, how ironically, Harlem's callous neglect for a long time. And I say callous neglect, I mean, it's very bizarre because if one looks at Bob Stern's book, New York 1960, you see all of these slum clearance projects that were planned for Harlem. Fortunately, only about a quarter of which were ever realized. So there was a lot of interest in creating a remedy for the problem of the Harlem slum, but so much of it was wrong-headed. The beneficial thing about this callous neglect was that when I got there in 1985, there survived in Harlem all sorts of ephemeral, magical kinds of things which you simply couldn't hope to find anywhere else. So one of the most poignant for me was that across the street from the Hotel Teresa, there was a store, and it sold, there was a store on the corner on the ground floor, and it sold sneakers and athletic socks. That was about the extent of what they sold. But what you noticed was that there are all these oak frame cabinets with glass panels and nickel-plated hardware, and that painted in reverse on each of these glass panels was a different flower, and then carefully lettered underneath the flower was the name of that individual flower. I thought, wow, what is this? And then it came to me that this had been a florist shop of a century before, and that they just left these cabinets and they stored their sneakers and their gym socks in the cabinets that had once held gardenias and violets, and that 100 years had gone by and that simply had not changed. So that was at 7th Avenue and 125th Street. At 125th Street near 3rd Avenue, there was a saloon, and it had swinging doors, just like you see in the Westerns. So there were doors inside of that that you could close, but like on a summer day, they would open those doors and you would just walk in and out of those swinging doors. Just, I thought, wow. But that's gone. That's gone, and much like it is gone. I mean, another delight of the Harlem of those days was you could visit a... many of the houses of worship in Harlem were previously synagogues or were previously owned by congregations of a different denomination. So that one of my favorite was this church that's now called the Mount Nebo Baptist Church at 114th Street, and they have been built in about 1909, I think, as Temple Anshei Hesed. And so when you go there today, it's very odd because you think, okay, well, what this synagogue building looked like was it looked like one of those English city churches that was built after the Great Fire. It's made out of brick and has an Ionic portico, and in the tympanum of the pediment there are these two tablets of the law. So you say a synagogue. But then when you look underneath the portico, there are three doors, and over one door is Queen Isabella of Aragon, and then King Ferdinand of, where is he from? Castile, I don't know, I don't remember. And so I thought, oh, a synagogue. I thought, oh, maybe these were maybe this were some congregation of Sephardic Jews or something. But then in the center panel, there's Christopher Columbus discovering America with a priest with a cross next to him. And you say, and you remember, oh, 1492, the Inquisition. So you say, no. But what you learn is that this synagogue, that the demographics of the southeastern portion of Harlem changed so dramatically that by the mid-20s, this synagogue had been sold to a congregation of immigrants from Puerto Rico who established in Temple Anshei Hesed, or what had been Temple Anshei Hesed, Our Lady of the Miraculous Medals Spanish Roman Catholic Church, which is now the Mount Nebo Baptist Church. Well, the Mount Nebo Baptist Church, they are renowned for their church choir, and they went to Paris and were well received there, and so now they call their choir the Mount Nebo Baptist Church Paris Choir. And to better showcase that choir, though, unfortunately, they took the chancel that had been built into the synagogue, where the artificial marble enframement of Corinthian columns and a pediment that had enframed the Ark of the Covenant became the enframement of an altarpiece in the form of a fake El Greco nativity scene. And alas, that was all thrown into a dumpster and a wider platform built to showcase the choir. And similarly, this over life-sized, particularly bloody and gruesome pietà by the entrance to the church that was smashed to bits and thrown into a dumpster. So all of that is very disenchanting because, you know, you experience this layering of culture upon culture, only it was there to be seen manifest in these elements. You know, one of my favorites was a little church on Lenox Avenue near 121st Street, I think it is. Or is it? No, I think it's 122nd Street. Anyhow, it's a now an African-American Protestant church, but it was originally built as the Unitarian Church of Harlem, and designed by Albert Herter, of all people. I mean, no, not Albert Herter, sorry. Designed by the guy who was the architect for Herter Brothers. What is his name? Is it Charles B. Atwood? I think it's Charles B. Atwood, who, when he worked for Herter Brothers, designed the William Henry Vanderbilt's Triple House. Well, he designed that church, and it didn't last too long as a Unitarian church, and became Temple Sons of Karawi, something or another. And the delight for me, go there, over the altar in this church, there was a square panel. And in that square panel, there was a cross with a crown over it, a cross with a little coronet over it. But at the edge of that square, you saw this, and you weren't really quite sure what it was, but then you realized that you were looking at the hindquarters and the tails of these lion supporters, these lions which once supported the tablets of the law, the conquering lions of Judah. And all that was left were so that was funny. Well, I went in there recently, and the sad thing is they made the cross even bigger. So the hindquarters and the tails are still there, but you almost don't see them because the cross now looms up even higher, and it's too bad. People just don't realize what remarkable thing they have, unfortunately. So, and that was readily apparent to me when I came to Harlem, and I thought, okay, well, I will start a preservation organization like the one I did in Akron. And I will do it in the same way. I will go to the New York Amsterdam News, and I will get them to let me write a guest editorial. And I met some guy there who was involved in their advertising department, and he wanted to help me, and I wrote something, but it never did get published. And other difficulty I ran into was just trying to work with the Landmarks Preservation Commission and with the various preservation organizations in the city in terms of Harlem. And what I discovered is that, like most people, preservationists are very selfish. What they're most concerned with is their own little territory. And justifiably so, because, you know, generally haven't even got enough funds to be able to deal with that small area, much less worrying about something outside of their area. But, you know, I still dream of the day that the notion of e pluribus unum will come to the fore, and preservationists will become a force more to be reckoned with because we're so united in our efforts to take on all comers. But that was not the case when I came here in 1985. But one very lucky thing that did happen was that Arlene Simon was aware of the existence of Harlem. And somehow or another, I don't remember how it was that I came to talk to her, but she suggested to me, she said, if you want to interest people in preserving Harlem, you should start a group, and moreover, you should invite groups from outside of Harlem to come and go on a tour. So she suggested names and groups that I should contact, and supplied me with numbers for these people. And so one of the people she connected me with was Christabel Goff, and that was very beneficial. Ultimately, I did start this group that I very pretentiously called the Upper Manhattan Society for Progress to Preservation. I did that deliberately, hoping that I'd give it some sort of gravitas that would make people take it seriously. And I was doing a little bit of writing in the Times in those days, and I was having a certain amount of success in getting Christopher Gray and others to write about things that we were concerned about. Recognized that was something that could be crucial, was being able to get coverage for what you were interested in. And I had a certain amount of luck doing that. And then I had a certain amount of luck getting friends who took an interest in me and my youthful efforts to allow me to use their name as advisory board members of the Upper Manhattan Society for Progress to Preservation. So we had Mara Bawada, the decorator, and Charles Adams Platt, the architect, and Robert A.M. Stern, the architect, and Pat Buckley, the socialite. So that was all to the good. And Christabel Goff. But the hard part of forming an organization and a membership and trying to cultivate new members and to have programs and meetings, that I never did master, nor was I ever able to get anyone to successfully delegate it to someone else to take on. In the midst of all of this, Arlene had also been talking to the politician David Patterson, who at that point, what in the devil was he? Was he the state senator? I think he was the state senator for representing Harlem. And he announced that he was going to be sponsoring a preservation organization called Landmarks Harlem, just like Landmarks West. That was derived from his consultation with Arlene. So I thought, oh, well, I'd be perfect to direct something like that. So I contacted his office, and his assistant, this woman named Gina Stalnecker, she said, oh, she was asking me questions about myself and etc. She was saying how she was from the South, and I said, oh, that's interesting. And then she asked me where I lived, and I said how I lived at this building on Hamilton Terrace, number 63. And She said, "Oh, you live in that terrible building." And I said, "Yes, it is. We do have a lot of problems." She says, "Well, we've tried to help them, but those niggers over there, they just don't seem to know what they are doing." And I said, "Oh, perhaps." We don't. Anyhow, so that made it not seem good. And then, so then I tried to contact Patterson directly and make a complaint about this, but I learned, of course, that particularly when you have staff, you're dependent on them, but if you are legally blind, you probably are extra dependent upon them, so you don't want to hear anything bad about them. And so nothing happened with that, and the next thing that happened was that I met this man named Thomas Bess, and he said to me, he thought of himself as a politically connected person, a black man, and he lived in the Bronx in their little tiny Longwood Historic District, and he said, "I'm going to arrange for you to work as a volunteer consultant to C. Virginia Fields, who's the new Harlem Council member, and you will be her preservation consultant, and between Virginia and me, we're going to see to it that you become the director of Landmarks Harlem." I said, "Oh, okay." So I went to work for Virginia, and that was a frustrating and difficult thing because, you know, not having any money and not having, and trying to do things at the same time, trying to save things, and everything, every time you looked around, something else was threatened with being destroyed. And when that thing was the Audubon Ballroom and Theater, where Malcolm X had been killed, Virginia was reluctant to come out against it, lest she offend Columbia, and who knows who else. So that was a frustration. She did permit me to go around to different meetings trying to denounce the plans to destroy the Audubon, but of course I was very limited in what I could say since I was supposedly representing her, so that sometimes I would say, "Well, I'm not saying this as a representative of the council member, I'm saying this on my own behalf, this is deplorable," whatever.
Mm. Tell me more about the Audubon Ballroom situation. Give it a little context.
It was a disaster. Thomas Lamb, the Scottish immigrant, came to America in the 1890s, I think it was, and he became a theater specialist. He is credited with designing something like 400 theaters around the world throughout his career. And the Audubon was completed in, I think, about 1910 or 12, and was built by the future movie mogul, William F. Fox, who founded 20th Century Fox. And as a consequence of that, Lamb has included a fascinating little architectural detail, and that is his building, which was what at the turn of the 20th century was known as a casino, because a place of pleasure where neighborhoods all over the country would have these casinos that usually included theaters and billiard parlors and restaurants and meeting rooms and dance halls. Well, the Audubon Casino included the Audubon Theater and a large ballroom, which is the room where Malcolm X was ultimately killed, and shops and restaurants, and On the Broadway side, it's devised as an arcade of elliptical arches, shallow elliptical arches that aren't carried on columns except at the entrance, but all the rest, which are windows, are carried on these piers. And at the springing of each arch is a terracotta, naturally colored fox head trophy, an allusion to William Fox. And then over the entrance is this bizarre detail, which I think can only have resulted from those terracotta elements having been on sale that by the supplier that week, because they relate to absolutely nothing. It is the prow of a galleon with oars. That has a big sort of Norse-looking mask of a bearded face on it, and then that's being pulled through these turbulent waters by this bare-breasted Triton with holding a sword aloft. So what did that relate to? Nothing. It doesn't relate to John James Audubon in any way. It's not his coat of arms or anything. It doesn't relate to anything. So, anyhow, that terracotta was all restored. Oh, anyhow, the Audubon started out as a vaudeville theater, and featured people who lived in the neighborhood, like the Marx Brothers and other comedy notables, and then it quickly, they added movies to the vaudeville house, and gradually the movies came to replace the these theatrical acts. And then in the ballroom where Malcolm X was killed was rented out for meetings, so there were early meetings of the New York Transit Workers Union that were held there, and when they were in formation, and there were annual dances. So there was this group called the Funmakers that would hold this annual drag ball around Thanksgiving time, and then ultimately, in the late 50s or early 60s, the theater started showing Spanish language movies and was renamed the San Juan Theater. Well, and then I guess it must have been in the 1970s that the theater was abandoned and that dances stopped happening in the ballroom, and the building was vacant, completely vacant. And I suppose it must have been one of those places where the owner relinquished on his taxes, because the building had come into city ownership, and the city was in negotiations with Columbia University to develop the property to create a biotechnological research laboratory. And the initial idea was to just demolish everything. And so initially I didn't really care about it one way or another. I didn't move me at all. Primarily, it didn't move me because I felt that by the time the Municipal Art Society, in the form of Charles Adams Platt and Kent Barwick, contacted me to try to involve me in doing something about it, because they wanted to have some black face to relate to this fight, I thought, well, you know, it's a foregone conclusion. This has all been decided and established. There were still all sorts of planning board meetings and things, but I just said, oh, this is already done. But ultimately, I thought, well, heck, Malcolm X is highly important, and maybe it can be saved. So, but the problem is, again, is that whether talking about the Municipal Art Society, now they are the traditional sort of preservationists. They are the people who like to think that they are a power working with, if not co-equal powers, with power colleagues in a courteous and decorous way to hammer out the future of the city. And the thing that always is central to their efforts is reasonableness. Well, they got outsmarted in their reasonableness. How? It was kind of like the way that Hillary Clinton got outsmarted with her healthcare plan that was so voluminous that no one could read it, and that her opponents could denounce it, saying all kinds of things that weren't true, but no one would be able to take the time to read it to discover that they weren't true. Well, similarly, the Municipal Art Society, their idea was that they would come up with a design that would show how the Audubon Project could be built incorporating the existing building. But to counter that, in all of the various newspapers, the Columbia and the Planning Commission and the city, they just said, well, they have come up with a plan. The Municipal Art Society has come up with a plan that is too expensive to produce and therefore impractical. And no one bothered to, even once it was said that it was too expensive or unworkable, nobody even bothered to examine whether that was true or not. So they got outsmarted. Then I was also unfortunate in my other colleagues who were the December 12th movement. I don't know if you remember back in those days when David Dinkins was the mayor, and African Americans in Brooklyn felt that Korean bodega owners were disrespectful to African American patrons at these various bodegas. And so there was one that they were picketing on a regular basis. So that was Sonny Carson and Alambe Brath and the December 12th movement. And I was trying to work with them. And to show how insignificant they felt that the Audubon was, and how they particularly felt that it was a done deal already, they decided that since their main gig was in Brooklyn, that they would relegate the Audubon to the youth movement branch of the December 12th movement. So I'm working with all of these people just out of high school on the Audubon, and we had a couple of marches and things, but nothing. And what we did do is we effectively went to some community board meetings. And that was interesting. I remember that J. Max Bond, the architect who liked to think of himself as kind of a black activist, he, you know, but by this time he was a total establishment figure. He had been the head of the School of Architecture at Columbia and would go on to be the head of the planning department of the city of New York, and